From KQED Public Radio and the California Report, this is the Capital Notes podcast for Friday, March 11th. I'm John Myers from KQED. Anthony York of the Los Angeles Times sitting here in the studio with me, out of breath after running from the Capitol to announce nothing has happened.
Yes.
Nothing officially, publicly has happened on our state budget watch. What are we, day 61 here on Friday? You want to do the clock?
No.
Come on, let's do the clock.
The count up,
Brown's
down,
budget.
And then things explode.
Yes.
Now what do we do?
Now what do we do?
You know, it is interesting, and perhaps...
Oh, now you're going to be serious. Go ahead.
Well, look, the headlines this week were, legislature misses budget deadline. And guess what? There was no real deadline. It was just basically an arbitrary day picked by the governor.
Yeah, it was a deadline set by the governor
right.
Based on a campaign promise.
But you wonder, you do wonder, I mean, to the average reader who...
listen.
The way most people read newspapers now
or
is...
Or listen to the radio?
No. The way they read newspapers is they look at the headline through the box and then don't buy it. You know, I mean... And so if the headline is... If the headline is legislature misses budget deadline, well, doesn't that sort of reinforce this idea of, oh, well, there they go again?
Are you now expressing some sad commentary on print journalism?
I'm a realist.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure what the equivalent is in radio. Of course, people often want to know even when something didn't happen for sure. They want us to tell them that, in fact, it didn't happen. And now back to your regular schedule
right.
News. And, of course, there's so much other really serious, dramatic stuff going on here at the end of the week that, you know, all of this almost kind of takes a break. But it doesn't take a break. You're listening to a political podcast, so what the hell, we're going to keep going.
Okay.
Okay.
Soldier on.
So as we sit here, the governor continues to chat with anyone and everyone who's willing to chat to see if he can find the votes he needs to move forward his package of cuts and tax extensions to go to a June ballot. The Republicans who are negotiating with him, the eponymous self-appointed GOP-5.
Oh, I mean, I just don't like the name. The concept is fine, but I don't like the name.
You know, John Fleischman, Mr. Republican diehard, is calling them the rogue GOP.
Yeah, that doesn't do it for me either. I see that my old friends at Capital Weekly are accepting nominations on how to christen the five.
How about Party of Five?
Party of Five.
I like that. That has a cultural reference. Plus, they may be
their
own.
Who gets to be Matthew Fox?
Yes. They may be their own Party of Five.
Yes.
Five Republicans in the state Senate.
Can I say I have reservations about Party of Five?
Nice.
No.
I like that. We're going to keep going. Okay.
Let's not.
So those five Republicans being Sam Blakesley, Republican of San Luis Obispo, Bill Emerson.
Republican of Hemet.
Of Hemet.
Tom Harmon.
Tom Harmon, Republican of Huntington Beach. Anthony Cannella.
Republican of Ceres.
And
Tom Berryhill.
Oh, yes.
Republican of Modesto.
My apologies to Mr. Berryhill. I almost forgot him there.
And to Modesto.
And to Modesto. Those five have been meeting group-wise, individually, staff-wise with the governor. They declared an impasse on Monday, which was an impasse in PR name only because they continued to meet.
That was their big launch, was declaring an impasse. I mean, that was the great irony of the week, right? Here we are. We're public. We've broken down. And, of course, it was not an impasse at all.
Right.
I mean, not in the traditional terms. It was the opening of... It was the opening of the next level of negotiations.
Our splash is a crash.
Yes.
So they put out a letter to the governor. We've declared an impasse, but of course they kept talking. And the letter gave a general overview of what their demands are to put a special election in front of the voters. And it included a pension reform, budget reform, regulatory reform. Oh, and by the way, just for fun, tax reform, keep redevelopment agencies, and keep enterprise zones.
Oh, and was tort reform on there too?
I don't think so.
I can't remember that drop off.
And a pint of Old Harper. Yes.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple of those that had the feeling of, shall we say, the first hostages to be killed in these negotiations. The pawns in this negotiation. Maybe that's a better. Some of the stuff felt a little bit tacked on, and it seems to have been whittled down now. Of course, this is all subject. This is fluid, right? But it seems that pensions, a spending cap, and CEQA reform seem to be at the heart of what is being discussed. Best that I can tell. If you're hearing something different, please
let us know. And CEQA reform, of course, some modification to the state's environmental law that governs development projects and things like that. Environmentalists put a public pushback this week saying don't do X, Y, and Z to CEQA. Pro Tem of the Senate, Daryl Steinberg, told me, don't worry, we're not going to screw up CEQA, though I can't remember exactly the way he...
Trust me. Right?
I can't quite remember how he phrased it with
it
me.
It wasn't
but,
that way?
He but didn't I listen, say what I... No, he didn't say it to the way I said it. But when I listened back to it, it was a, we're not going to damage CEQA. And of course, that's not saying we're not going to make any modifications. It says we're not going to damage it. Anyway, let's don't get into
semantics.
Well,
what can we say? There were lots of closed-door meetings and open letters, right? I mean, that was sort of the week that was. And through those
Good night,
letters,
everybody.
And through those letters, we can kind of divine what's going on in the budget talks.
Somebody wrote a story, said, if you look at the letters, can you divine what's going on?
Yeah, yeah.
A young man.
Not as young as he used to be, let me tell you.
But anyway, talk about those. Talk about all of that. Talk about the letters, but from the GOP five to the environmentalists.
We start with that in that long list, and then you know, there's a pension coalition that is all the major labor organizations, including the ones that the governor is going to need to bankroll this election if and when it happens. They put out their own letter once this idea of pensions went public. A wide coalition of environmental groups, as you mentioned, put out their letter. And then we saw a group of traditionally more moderate group of at least socially moderate Republicans, the new majority, a well-financed group, a group that supported the 2009 special election package, coming out and saying, well, really, at the heart of our list are pensions and a spending cap. And so, you know, if you accept that these letters mean something, then perhaps that discussion has been whittled down a bit.
And yet, let's crack those two issues open a moment, because
sure you want to? The black box of the state budget, as Brown called it, right?
Black box for a
he's opening
governor.
Up the block box. Remember that?
Yeah,
Monday?
Yes.
Was that this Monday?
Was that
right?
Really this week?
It really
where
was.
He talked to the Community College Board of Governors and then us afterwards? Gosh, what a long week.
Yes.
But I want to crack open pension and spending cap for a moment, because while those topics sound great, the details are hugely important and hugely complicated. And I think that if those are really the focus of the talks,
we're in trouble.
The question is, how do you know, what does it take to declare victory? Because let's take pension reform first. There are places Democrats will not go. They will not go to the 401k.
Right.
Idea.
No.
They will not go to the cracking open the pensions of existing workers idea.
Regardless of what the little Hoover Commission.
Exactly. I mean, that you and I both hear that. That's a no-how, no-way kind of thing. So what is it Republicans are willing to settle for? Some of the ideas that Governor Brown put on his campaign website, like spiking of employee salaries and pensions, a cap, some kind of cap system on how much pension benefits you can get. Is that A, will Democrats accept that? B, is that enough for Republicans?
Right.
And then on spending cap, which is an idea that has been around forever, dating back even to the spending cap in the late 70s that was put on the place. Feels like forever.
Forever? No, never mind.
I don't get the cultural reference.
Well, that's okay. We'll discuss off air.
Someone on the podcast, listening to the podcast, will get that. I'm just too much of a fuddy-duddy. And then on the spending cap issue.
Outcast, anyway.
I get it. How do you craft that? How do you craft something that Democrats will accept? There's a measure on the ballot in 2012, while not a spending cap, is somewhat of a limitation based on some linear regression model of revenues over the long term.
You said linear regression model.
Republicans have wanted a hard cap for years that was limiting state spending to the combination of population growth and inflation, something to that effect. Democrats have not wanted that for various reasons.
Right.
We don't really know what's in the GOP 5 proposal, though it appears, at least they told Deborah Saunders, that's the only place I saw it, that education would be outside of the spending cap, which raises another set of policy issues. The point I'm trying
to... I'm confused. Bring it home for me.
Yeah, the point I'm trying to bring home to you, baby, is that this is complicated stuff to be sitting here talking about under this time frame. And with the stakes this high, with every little push you make to the right might tick off somebody to the left. I mean, the governor's got a heck of a task in front of him finding that sweet spot.
Right.
And talked about pension to reporters out in the hallway this morning, apparently. Friday morning we're sitting here. Briefly was seen going in and out of finance. Another reporter tweeted it. That's how
right.
I know this.
Right.
But this is a lot of stuff to do. And he does get to a point where he cannot go much further about the election. I mean, we don't know what that deadline is. But at a certain point, local elections officials are going to tell him, we can't pull it off that yeah. fast.
Well, look, there's all these policy concerns, and they're linked so closely with the political concerns. And increasingly, the vibe this week, I mean, I think the governor did a very good job in the first 2 months of this discussion to make it look, sound, and feel different than 2009. And this week, just some of these things, as we get closer mm-hmm. to the end, some of these fundamental tensions, you know, that were there in 2009 that
deja
helped
vu.
Sink 2009 are coming up again. On the issue of the spending cap, remember Prop 1A in 2009, the tax increases, the tax extensions actually, were linked to a spending cap. The service employees broke off, did not support the package, and that was part of what helped sink the 2009 package. Brown knows that. He's aware of that, that keeping labor unified, and when we're talking about labor, you know, the real shorthand for that are the service employees and the teachers union. I mean, that's what we're talking about, because those are the unions that Brown is going to ask to fund this campaign. And I am picking up a little bit of the, and whether it's just a venting or a snapshot in time of where we are, but I am picking up from some folks on the left, some folks in the labor world, why are we doing this? Why are we going to vote for a bad budget, and then allow ourselves to get leveraged on these core issues that don't affect the short-term problem? And then we're going to be asked to bankroll this thing. And after all that, we've got at best a 50-50 shot of making it go. And I think that's a big and the only reason that we have to go to the ballot at all is because the governor made a political promise. And I think that I'm sensing that frustration, and
right.
I don't know how that frustration manifests or ultimately impacts these negotiations.
Well, the thing that I think I am going to be very curious to watch over the next few days is, one, will we get the signs early? But one, once this is all done, let's say for sake of argument for a moment that it actually happens. Not only what's in the package of concessions, agreements, modifications, whatever we'll call the Republican wish list, but what's the structure of them getting passed? Because the governor has made it very clear he wants a single ballot measure on the June 7th ballot. But right. yeah, wait for it here, because this goes back to your 2009 thing. If the governor says, we can't put it all on the ballot, guys, Mr. Republicans, you know, we can't put it all this time, we'll put it on the next few ballots. Then there are going to be Republicans who are going to balk and say, well, all of your interest groups are going to kill it when it comes up for a vote.
Of course.
If you put, but on the flip side, just as you alluded to, if you put it on the ballot in a June special election, they're going to be the interest groups who are saying, why do I want to fund that when it's got stuff I don't like in it? And so this is that's the fundamental dilemma there is, like,
right.
it's not just the reforms, but how the reforms are put in place, what's voted on, what's approved, what campaign
right.
comes out.
Well, and there are these polls flapping around in the ether out there that
– flapping polls.
That suggest, you know, I'm not sure how credible they are, but there are
but you'll talk about them on the podcast.
Well, there are these private polls that are circulating that are at least aimed at factoring into this conversation that suggests that the tax has become more palatable to voters if they're linked to pension changes and a spending cap. I'm not sure I buy it. I'm not sure the governor buys it. I'm not sure the union folks buy it. It may or may not be true. I don't know. But that's part of the conversation. I mean, the pension stuff, look, there's no reason the pension stuff would have to go to the ballot. You could do that in legislation and link that bill to the passage of the taxes. I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't do that. Spending cap, I believe, would have to be a constitutional amendment. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, podcast listener, but I think that that's the case. I believe that 1A was a constitutional amendment. And so, it's tricky. I mean, it's, and it, look, these things always feel like they're about to blow up right before they close, you know? So, I'm picking up some frustration and some tension there, whether that will ultimately doom this thing or it's just a necessary process we need to go through before we get to an eventual agreement. We'll find out in the next week or two.
The other thing that's interesting on just the process, to me too, becomes, and I've, you know, and I don't know that you, maybe you've gotten a better answer from the world of the governor to this than I have. But let's remember that one of the non-budgetary factors here is the election timeline and the election schedule. And something a decision the governor made a few weeks ago is going to play out on Monday. That is, the governor asked Jane Harmon to delay her resignation from Congress so that he could consolidate the special election he hopes to have on the tax extensions with the special election to replace her in the 36th congressional district down in the L.A., Marina Del Rey, right?
Long Beach.
Southern California area.
Does it go down to Long Beach? I'm not sure. I don't know if it goes that far.
I don't think I know. Yeah. Manhattan Beach.
There's some beach cities involved. Yeah. Palos Verdes.
Let me not get specific because someone from that area will tell me I'm wrong, and I'm not a big SoCal expert. But so here we are. By law, he has to call a special election within 14 days. She resigned on the 28th. The 14th day is Monday. Uh-huh. So one way or the other, unless, of course, I guess he tries to supersede that law, which I'm not sure he can, the governor has to call a special election for the Harmon seat on Monday. If he calls it on June 7th, then that means, I guess, that's the day he's now working toward for the other. If he calls it on June 14th, are we all going to say, that's the new day he's working for?
Yes, I mean, we will.
We all will do that. But, I mean, so come Monday, even if the negotiations aren't finished, we're going to have some kind of outlay as to where that goes. I mean, I assume the governor could always separate the Harmon race from the statewide. But given he made a big to-do about saving the money to do that.
Right. It would be an extra election in L.A. County, probably cost, I've heard estimates of $3 to $4 million. If possible, the governor would like to avoid those costs and be able to consolidate these elections. But yes, I think Monday is a clue about that.
A clue. Fair enough.
Yeah. Okay. Good talk.
A couple of other things. Let's talk a little about a couple of things that came up this week. One was this whole notion of what also happens next week, which is the state Republican Party holds its semiannual. I never know. They meet twice a year, folks.
Semiannual.
I'm not smart enough to figure it out.
Semi means half annual year, right?
We'll go with that.
Okay.
Their semiannual convention kicks off a week from today.
From today.
So next Friday in Sacramento. And a lot of people have said, what lousy timing for Republicans who might be willing to break away from the party orthodoxy on having a special election on taxes. Of course, past being prologue or past being worth noting, in 2009, the state convention was held in Sacramento about a week or two after the Republicans broke away, the ones that did, and voted for an actual tax increase. Mm-hmm. And there was a whole push to censure them during the convention gathering in Sacramento.
Yep.
Do you think the convention plays a role here, or are these Republicans already assuming they're going to get beaten up at the convention?
I don't know that it does. This is, again, among the things that gets discussed. Anytime you try to delve into the way a legislator's mind works, you're setting yourself up for trouble.
You don't want to dig down into that.
You just don't know. I just don't know what people are thinking and how they see the world when it comes to trying to maneuver around these political obstacles and whether that there's a political endgame in mind. I mean, there's one line of thought that says, that's going to fast track a deal because they want some time to pass. They want the full week to pass before the convention. Well, that hasn't happened as of this recording.
Which gets us to thought, the slow walk of
then,
the
then there's like, well, maybe they want to delay it until after the convention so they don't have to face the music. Or maybe it's a good sign that these five senators aren't for real in the first place and they're going to blow this whole thing up and walk into the convention as heroes, I mean, who knows? Does it factor into the minds of some of these guys? Yeah, they're aware of it. They're aware of the calendar. Again, I don't know, I don't know how important that is. I've asked that same question of some of these members, and I just, you know, the political answer, of course, is no, we are doing this for the good of California, and, you know, regardless of any, you know, arbitrary political gathering or political deadline. Well, yeah, maybe, maybe. I mean, pardon me for being cynical, but in terms of how that motivates their thinking, I don't know.
The whole convention thing took on a very strange little twist this week, too, when the chairman of the state Republican Party, Ron Nearing, suggested a debate at the state Republican convention. I have to admit it, I would love to have seen it.
Between, well, which one?
Yeah, well, they're both. Between, we'll get there, folks. He suggested a debate between Grover Norquist, the nationally known anti-tax advocate who has pushed the no-tax pledges, not only about tax increases in general, but the pledge about not holding an election on taxes. A debate between Norquist and Governor Brown, and that would have been fascinating. And, of course, Governor Brown's people replied, well, probably a more appropriate debate partner for Mr. Norquist would be Sutter, the first dog. And so then there was a—
If I had a flip cam and some cheap editing software and a little more time on my hands, I could make that debate happen.
you could mash those
exactly
two together.
Somebody please, with, you know, a YouTube account and a little free time, can someone make that debate, arrange that,
and send
I'll link to it on the LA Times blog.
Well, I'll link it myself. Send us both a link if you come up with that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the governor's folks had a little fun with that with Sutter, and of course, whoever the mysterious tweeter is for the dog tweeted, Exactly. Do you have a little?
I do.
Do you have a hic?
It's flu season.
It almost sounded as though you said Glazer.
No, I don't think that's what I said.
The dog apparently tweeted, "I'll have to check my schedule," which in itself was funny too. So.
Well, and then the dog uncharacteristically tweeted something like "This is the only Grover I know," linking to a photo of Sesame Street's Grover. That seemed a little out of character for Sutter's Twitter doppelganger.
To which then I think Grover Norquist said it was childish, and on we went. I mean, total sideshow, folks, but, you know, again—
What else are we going to talk about?
The world in which we live.
Yeah.
Last thing I was just going to chat about, and there is no answer to this, but I think
it's— The answer is 12.
Okay. Goodbye, everyone. This is a very important chapter in the Brown returns to governor legacy. This is a very important point in that chapter, because it's the first big test of whether or not he can get something done. If he gets something done, it will be scrutinized ad nauseum about, was it enough? Was it good? Was it bad? And then what? And I don't want to get too far past where we are, because we don't have a deal. It has no resolution.
Well, either way, then what?
But then what? I mean, then what? Not only for the short term of more cuts or a campaign over taxes, but then what else does the governor want to focus on, too? I mean, if he can get past the budget. I mean, it all kind of goes to the larger—
He's talked about it. He's talked about green energy and corrections and water. I mean, he's outlined a couple of major policy areas that he wants to get to after this budget. But I do think, you know, even before that, it is interesting that he's foreshadowing a world in which, you know, whether it fails in the legislature or at the ballot box, he's foreshadowing a world in which sort of pits the governor against Democrats in the legislature.
Yeah, and talk about that. That was the sit down he did with George Skelton, LA Times
but,
columnist.
Well, he mentioned it. He's mentioned it. He mentioned it Monday as
but
well.
He said it very well to George. I thought
it was a
war of all wars, or a war of everybody against everybody.
The mother of all battles. Oh yeah, all against all. I think it was.
Yes.
I'm sure there's a Latin phrase for it.
I think it was in Latin first, and then he translated it for Skelton. Says. But no, I mean, but he right exactly. I mean, and that in itself. Well, it's interesting.
Well, look, for right now, the unions whose political support is crucial are negotiating directly with the administration, right? I mean, the legislature, I think fair to say, now that there's a Democratic governor, the legislature and the legislative leaders are less pivotal to this process than they were this time last year, right? That being said, if we get into a situation where we're talking about what Brown has characterized as an all-cuts budget, that could very well shift, and that, you know, and that some of these labor groups will be doing their advocacy and making their political plays through the legislature, and you know, and there will be a rapid devolution of the relationship between the governor's office and the legislature. I mean, I just Brown himself is aware of that. He's girding for that, if you will, because that is a possible, if not probable, outcome. Again, you know, Brown has to thread the needle both to get this thing to the ballot and then get it passed. I mean, those are two, as they as in the parlance of the day that we hear a lot, those are a couple of very big lifts, right? I mean, and
we haven't heard that since Arnold, but that's another.
Well, yeah. I hear it every freaking day from the people I talk to. So, and you know, and we'll see. And that seems to be Brown's attitude. It's like, hey, he's gonna take the world as he finds it. He's laid out where he wants to go, what he wants to do, and if it doesn't happen, then you know, then they'll deal with that then.
In which case, I think the only observation I have is that it's I don't want to overly applaud the governor or give him too much credit, because I don't know what the outcome of what he's trying to do is. But if what he does not try to do, if what he tries to do is not successful, that's the proper way to say it. Yeah. Then perhaps it is time to finally have that discussion. Perhaps it is finally time to let that all out battle happen. I mean, because you know, again, we have, and I'm not trying to mimic all of his rhetoric, but right, I mean, we have delayed the day of reckoning for years about what's valuable, what's not, what are you willing to pay for it, what do you want, what do you don't want, everything else. If his solution doesn't work, then let's have it.
Now, here's what I don't know. Again, podcast listener, if you're out there, can a budget be implemented through a veto override? I mean, if there were a two-thirds majority that formed on a list of agreements, again, you know, to pass. I mean, Brown has said he won't pass a budget that has gimmicks or that has taxes in it without a vote of the people. If that budget is vetoed, could it be overridden and implemented? I don't see why it couldn't, but I don't know if there's anything specific about a budget.
If a budget is different than another bill.
I just don't know.
But even then, an override is a two-thirds vote.
Well, right. So the point being, if you get these Democrats and a group of Republicans together that are not bound by the same political pledge that Brown is, could we see that? I mean, could we see that as a possibility where the legislature gets together and has their own vision, you know, and passes something that Brown, as governor, doesn't support and doesn't sign?
It's a gimmick budget, a something budget.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. I mean, again, that's something that we can talk about after June. We could talk about that this summer as a possible scenario. I mean, that's looking far down the field a little bit, but just let's come back to that, shall we?
Let's do. And I'm sure someone will email in and say, "Oh, Anthony, you are so wrong."
I'd be surprised if they didn't.
As you say, what day does not that happen?
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, that's Anthony York from the LA Times, duly chastened. And I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.